a political biography today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Lane Evans was a beloved Illinois congressman from this area. Devin Hansen, his biographer, joins us today on Scribble. Devin, you know, I don't know what I'm doing anyway. Devin, what motivated you to do this biography?
Having grown up in the Quad Cities my entire life, born in 1975, Lane was elected to Congress in 1982, and I first met him when I was 8 years old in 83, and I followed his career as a political junkie for many years after that, and I knew how much of a legend he was here in the Quad Cities, so I wanted to try to bring his story to a national audience.
Yeah, he was quite a guy. I knew him as a student when I was teaching at Alleman. He was never in my class, but, you know, he was well known, and the thing about him is he never changed. What he was as a student, he was as a congressman.
Yeah, and I think that's what endeared a lot of people to him. You know, he didn't want to change for political reasons, or, you know, he wasn't putting his finger to the wind to see where the polls were going. You know, he always voted his conscience. And, you know, one story in the book, he talks about his hair. He's like, everybody told me to cut my hair because he had this really ugly Beatles cut. And he said, well, if I cut my hair, then I'm going to start changing other things. So something simple as a haircut meant a lot more to him.
A friend of mine in Congress called me one time after Lane was in office. And he said, I'm worried about your friend because he is not willing to take a political vote. Now, a political vote is when your vote doesn't count. I mean, the issue is settled. And you can vote a way that you normally wouldn't just so that you don't anger people on the other side. And he said, I'm worried about him. You should talk to him. I thought, well, we'll see. So then he called me a month later and he said, I take that back. He is the most honest person in voting I've ever met. He votes the way he is convinced it should be, and no other consideration comes into play. Says he's a very admirable person. He shouldn't change.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, that's Lane.
I think that's what people loved about him. You know, even people from the other side of the aisle, they may have disagreed with him, but, you know, they admired his, pardon the plug, but they admired his guts. So.
Yeah. Read us a little something from your biography.
Sure. Just a real quick preface. This is an excerpt from a chapter where the book is a dual narrative. So half the book is chronicling the last few years of Lane's life, battling Parkinson's, and the other half of the book is a detailed account of his career. So this is one of the chapters that's kind of a first-person account, and it's taking place right after Obama was elected president. And Lane was there on election night with Obama in a suite as he learned that he was president. So I'll pick up here on Inauguration Day. And now here we are on Inauguration Day, staring at a television in the basement in Silvis, Illinois, watching Yo-Yo Ma saw at his cello and Aretha Franklin sing in her big bowed hat. I sat in a chair catty-cornered to Lane as Obama took the oath. Obama put his hand on Lincoln's Bible and Lane's chin quivered. Jenny Shelton, one of Lane's oldest and closest staffers, came to the couch and put a hand on Lane's shoulder, her own eyes wet with tears. I wonder if they were for joy or sadness or a mixture of both. We all knew Lane should have been on that balcony watching his friend, not on some couch in a basement 1,000 miles away. After Obama's speech, Lane was ready to leave. He was tired. I helped him to his feet. He and Cher worked the room one last time. When they were done, Cher went upstairs to get his shoes and his coat, while his friend Richard went outside to warm up the car. I waited at the bottom of the stairs, holding the congressman by the elbow. He looked me in the eyes, pulled his arm from my grip, and clasped the railing. "Wait a minute, Lane. We should wait for Cher." "We should wait for Cher," I said. He ignored me and put one foot on the step. I looked behind me. No one in the room said a word. "Lane, please," I pleaded. But he had already made it to the first step. I took him by the elbow, frightened. I could see the headlines. "Neglected Congressman Breaks Hip," or "Biographer Sends Evans to the Hospital." He made it to the second step, then another, and another. At the halfway mark, I let him go and said, "Hoorah!" Lane smiled and pushed even harder. I could see it in his face. He wanted to say, "I am still here. I am your congressman. I am Lane Allen Evans." He made it to the top of the stairs, breathless. I patted him on the back and said, "Good job, sir." Cher appeared in the hall. Her eyes widened and she nearly dropped his coat. "I tried to stop him," I shrugged. She let out a long, exasperated breath. "You scare me to death, buddy." Lane gave her a wry smile, and Cher knelt down and put on his shoes. We walked to the car, and Richard drove us home slowly. We were all jovial, talking of the future and the past, and when we pulled up to the nursing home, Lane turned to me and asked, "Well, are you coming up for a beer with the boys?" "No, sir," I laughed. "I need to get home." He grinned and said, "Maybe next time." Cher walked him to the entrance. I watched in admiration as he shuffled along, the man who had just witnessed his apprentice become the leader of the free world. But I knew that today, in front of all his former staff, conquering those stairs was an even greater achievement.
That's very nice.
That is good. Yeah.
That is good, yeah.
You called him sir rather than Lane. Is that your relationship to him, or?
If I was angry, maybe I'd call him Lane, or... Or joking around, but yeah, I try to always express that respect to him.
But it's also more distant.
That's true.
It seems to me that you have an advantage and a disadvantage in being as close to Lane as you were, because you know things and you know him in a way that a lot of people don't know, which is the purpose of the biography. But at the same time, you're so close to him that you might have a little clouded vision.
Yeah, I think, you know, with his staff and everyone, he always wanted everybody to call him Lane. And I think maybe he did get mad at me sometimes for calling him sir, but that was kind of my upbringing. And it was hard to break away that respect. I guess that's one thing I talk about in there. You know, as a biographer, I struggled with, you know, like being a nature photographer. Do you watch the little fawn drown in the lake so you can get the footage, or do you intervene?
Right.
So, so I wrestled with that a lot. I actually wrestled a lot with even interjecting myself in the book because I didn't want to come across as narcissistic. But then I guess I came to a point where I was like, well, you know what? I'm his friend. I need to give my opinion. And so it was a tightrope that I walked, I'd say.
How did you first come into contact with Lane?
The first time I met him, like I said, was 83, but that was just, I was just a child. And we used that book as the author photo in here. But I owned a movie theater in Rock Island called the Bruin View in the early aughts. And then in 2003, he had an election office across the street. So a lot of his staffers would come in and have a beer or watch a movie, and then he would start coming in to see movies and whatnot too. So I'd bend his ear and, you know, just drag him to the side and talk to him for a bit. And then that's when they asked me about holding a fundraiser for Lane. And I said, heck yeah, definitely. I'd be honored to. Well, we set up the fundraiser, and the day of the fundraiser, they tell me, oh, well, he's going to bring around this this other guy named Obama. I'm like, oh. I was like, oh, great. I was like, who's this guy? I've never heard of him. You know, what? I want to know this guy's politics before I have him in my joint. But then I figured, well, I guess if he's a friend of Lane, he's a friend of mine. So they had the event there at the Bruin View, and we had maybe, I don't know, 40 people. And Obama spoke, and everybody was like, oh, man, this guy should be president. when we were all cleaning up, we're like, oh, his name sounds too much like Osama. Nobody will vote for him.
And, well, that turned out to be a problem.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, Barack Hussein Obama. Yeah.
Exactly.
Got the whole thing. But yeah, it's amazing how Obama was able to charm people. He was down in Cairo, and Cairo is like the Deep South. It really is. A black person is a black person there. And Obama was talking to an all-white audience, you know, old-timers. He won them over completely.
Yeah.
I mean, he just, there was something about the guy that made it work. Lane was very quiet. He didn't impress in the way that Obama did. Obama could get you right now. But with Lane, he just kind of grew on you. They talk about him walking down the halls at Alaman, you know, quietly, smiling, friendly. He just never changed, as we said.
Well, he just does not seem, you know, knowing we were going to do this interview today, I got to thinking about what title you would give Lane, and you wouldn't call him a politician, right? But on the other hand, he's not a statesman either. He wasn't old enough and had enough of experience to be. What title would you call him? I mean, what was he?
Well, in his office, you call him the Honorable Lane Evans, and that's a very good title for Lane.
Yeah.
That really is. It's not to, we should let Devin talk here, but Harold Washington, when I visited him once, we went to lunch, and some guy shouted to him, "Harold, Harold, Harold." And we went to lunch, and I said, "You know, you've been mayor, you've been congressman, you've been senator. Which title do you prefer?" Says, "You heard that guy, give me the title I want, Harold."
Right.
He says, "I always want to be Harold. I don't want to be anything else." And Lane was kind of like that. He just wanted to be Lane. Yeah.
So at what point did you decide you were going to do a biography of Evans?
Well, it kind of came to me in 06. I was just leaving a job, and I forget what really spawned it, but I just knew that, you know, he had such a good story to tell, and he had just retired from Congress a short time ago, and knowing his influence on Obama and the ties that we had, I thought, well, this would be a great story to pursue. So I started out I headed down to Western Illinois University. They have his library down there, but it wasn't even set up yet. They just had boxes and boxes of stuff, so I spent several days there just pouring through documents and...
So did you get his permission to do the biography?
Yes, yeah.
How did he feel about that?
He was pretty excited about it. Okay. Unfortunately, it wasn't published until after he passed away, but he was excited about it. You know, I got the sign-off from his caretakers, his guardians and whatnot, but for legal purposes. But he was excited about it. You know, the first time we met, that's where I got the title for the book. Guts. I hadn't seen him for many years, and I went in, and the first question I wanted to ask him, I said, you know, what makes a person great? You know, what makes a man? And the first thing he said was guts. You know, be willing to stand up, take a punch, and, you know, stand by what you believe in. And so we just, that kind of gave me the whole idea for the entire book about how to write it and whatnot. And then
how many interviews did you have with him?
Countless. I was seeing him once a week for many years, sometimes to interview him, sometimes just to watch a movie or spend some time with him. You know, some days he was real aware and verbal, and other days he was in a lot of pain. And I do document those instances in the book as well. Not to exploit him or anything like that. It's more to show people what Parkinson's is like and how painful and how hard it is to deal with. But so I wanted to show, you know, here's this man. I wanted to have this juxtaposition of these great things he accomplished, and then once you're out of Congress, you know, and you're alone and in pain. So it's kind of a chronicle of the final days of his life, too.
Yeah. It's did you go to Washington? Did you talk to people out there?
I did have quite a few interviews with folks from Washington. I never did fly out there, but yeah, we've got interviews with David Axelrod, Obama, Harkin, you know, a lot of Mike Honda, quite a few, Jan Schakowsky. So a lot of people that were involved in his early campaign and then later on in his career became powerful themselves. And so a lot of his staffers, a lot of his friends. And so it was 8 years of research, and that was a lot.
Yeah, it's and, you know, you can never uncover everything.
Right.
There are all kinds of details. It's interesting. I remember he first got his start in politics working the gates with me when I ran in 72. And he came to see me when he was going to run for Congress. And he asked me, he says, how do you campaign against, who was the guy in?
Railsback?
What?
Was it Railsback?
Yeah, Railsback. And I said, well, you're not going to be running against Railsback, because Railsback is going to lose the primary. You'll be running against Ken McMillan, and you should be able to beat him. And that's the way it turned out. So I knew Railsback was going to pay the price for voting for Nixon's impeachment.
Right.
And because in primary, only the passionate vote. And I figured, yeah, that's Lane is in trouble. That's on everybody's mind now, thinking about impeachment.
Yeah, and you know, and Lane voted to, you know, for the, not the impeachment, but the impeachment inquiry of Bill Clinton. And he was just, I think, one of 30 Democrats maybe that did that. And he said he wanted to do that just to bring all the facts to light, you know, so we could know.
Yeah, there's no reason to vote against an inquiry.
Right.
I mean, if you vote against an inquiry, that is a stain, because you should always find the facts.
Yeah.
But how would you summarize his career?
I think it was one that accomplished a lot for the little folks, but didn't get a lot of recognition. You know, his major, the bill that he really hangs his hat on is the Agent Orange Act of 1991, which he fought for since basically 82. He was fighting for it for 9 years, but he was only a co-sponsor of it because Sonny Montgomery, who was the chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, pretty much took credit for it and sponsored the bill. So, and it was all based on Lane's verbiage, et cetera, and his ideas. So, you know, there were numerous instances where there were just bills that pretty much, I won't say plagiarized, but, you know, took Lane's idea and went with it, but they had more seniority. And Lane even acknowledged that. He said, you know what? He's like, I've learned right away in Washington, it's better to have seniority than it is to be right.
So. Well, but, you know, and that is, I believe in that tactic. If you want to get something done, let somebody else get, you do the work and let somebody else put their name on it.
Yeah.
And then if you choose the right person, then that bill is going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, and Lane was good about that. He understood how to get things done. You don't make a big name for yourself, but you're very effective. And I remember when he came to see me after I lost the election in 80, he said, I learned a lesson from you. Never stop campaigning. So he came back every week.
Do you think but the position of congressman was his calling, or had he not gotten ill, would he have gone on to the Senate and on up, or did he have other ambitions?
Yeah, I hypothesize with people all the time about that. Had he not gotten sick, where would he be? You know, I'm assuming after Paul Simon, he would have ran for Senate, and then we would have never had Obama. But had he gotten sick maybe after Obama, he would have had a cabinet position for sure in Obama's administration. Mm-hmm. But I think he probably would have run for Senate for Paul Simon's seat.
Yeah, that's those, you know, what if. Politics is the sort of thing that turns on a dime sometimes. And It's like when Obama was urged by Dick Durbin to run for president. Durbin said, the time is now. If you're going to do it, it's now, or, you know, if you wait, the time, you know, the opportunity will pass. And that turned out to be exactly right.
Yeah, I think Lane was too honest to be president. But
what made him decide to get into politics in the first place?
Well, he wanted to be a public servant. A fun nugget in the book is before Alleman, he actually went to seminary school to be a priest, but he only spent a few weeks there, and then he left. So his mother and really pushed him to live a life of public service. So that's kind of what he saw being a congressman as, is being a priest. You know, the constituents were his parish, his parishioners, and that's another reason he didn't get married. He felt that, you know, one would suffer. If he was married, his family would suffer, or his job would suffer, vice versa. So he really saw it as a service to the people.
Mm-hmm. Where can people acquire a copy of your book?
It's available everywhere books are sold. Everywhere books are sold.
Okay.
So like Barnes & Noble, Amazon. If you're going non-corporate, you can get it from IndieBound. Locally, it's at Barnes & Noble and the Book Rack.
And the name is Guts.
Yep, Guts, the Lane Evans story.
Well, I must say, you must have had an interesting time going through all this. What's it like to dig into another person's life?
Since I followed him for so many years, I kind of already had a really good idea of who he was and what he stood for. But it was very interesting going through all the old memos and whatnot, the secret memos you see from Dick Gephardt saying, "Don't push George Bush too hard," and things like that. So it was really interesting as a political junkie to see all the little behind the scenes information that we don't always see in the news. And now
you have your book, and now everybody can take a look at this and get to know Lane Evans a bit more.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us, Devin.
Well, thank you.
And the book is Guts, and it's easily available. You know, something struck me powerfully when I was listening to our conversation with Devin, that Lane had been in the seminary and decided—
I did not know that.
Yeah, I did not know that either. But what struck me is I was in the seminary too.
Right.
And I remember when I went down for the orientation when I was first elected to the Senate, it was an icy night. I was on a two-lane road, solid line of cars. You could see a rosary of red lights.
Right.
And occasionally one would just slip off the road as if the finger of God had flicked them off. But as I was inching my way along, I got to thinking about being in the seminary. And I thought, I could not do that, but I can do this. And I approached it with the same feelings that I had when I entered the seminary. And I thought, that's interesting, that impulse to be a priest and is not too far away, if you take it seriously, from public service as a congressman, senator, anything. And that just resonated with me very strongly. That he was a very interesting young man.
He was really interesting. You know, he wasn't— usually, to get any place in Rock Island County, you had to be part of the machine, and he was not a machine guy.
No.
Well, neither were you, but...
No, that's true, and sometimes you are lucky enough to be able to come in from outside, and that way I remember a guy said, well, who do you answer to? one of my Chicago colleagues. I said, well, really nobody, you know, just the voters. I haven't been in the organization, so I don't have any strong ties there. Now, I think strong ties within a political organization are important, and I worked to establish some of those. But it meant, though, that you are remarkably free, that you can pretty much just follow issues.
He seemed to me, even in sort of the way he walked, that he was much more of a loner than most politicians are.
Yep.
Yep. Right? I mean, they're not glad. He didn't glad hand people at all.
No, but he was very wise in coming back every week just to go places and meet people and be seen.
Right.
You know, it takes two qualities in politics. You have to be a campaigner, and then you have to be able to function in office. And very often, you find one quality or the other. The problem is, if you're only a campaigner and then you get into office, you can be almost useless.
But he didn't even seem to me to be doing much campaigning. I'm sure he did more than I was aware, but everybody liked him.
Well, it was not campaigning in the sense that, you know, you have bells and whistles and balloons falling and so on, but he would just go to where people were and talk to them and visit. And just being visible was the best way to do it. And as a loner, I was not too good at that. I campaigned like the devil the first year and figured, that's it. I'm not going to do this anymore. But that was a mistake, as he pointed out to me. And so he came back every week, and he went out to wherever people were, and he would go to meetings or just go out with friends. But he was visible all through the district. And that was a prudent thing to do, but his heart and soul really was in office, what he did in office, and carrying out his responsibilities as a representative.
Is it true that in Washington he slept many nights in his office? He had a cot in there?
I wouldn't doubt it. How else could he afford to keep coming back home on weekends? You know, I remember another friend of mine was elected to Congress, and he talked about it. He said, you know, it takes more money than I have to live in Washington. So he would sleep in his office, too. And that's not all that unusual, because Washington is a hideously expensive place. And if you want to be there, also, people will sometimes go together. Several representatives will go together to rent a place where they all can stay. If you like dormitory life, well, then that's it. But I don't doubt that Lane slept in his office a fair amount, because that's the way to survive in Washington. But anyway, I would recommend that book to anyone who would like to know a little bit more about Lane Evans, because he was truly, I think, an exceptional person, quite different from what you might call the normal run of politicians. And we've, as normal, run out of time. But I'm Don Wood with Roll Tweet. We appreciate your attention tonight, and we hope that you'll be back with us next week when we'll return with another session of Scribble.